It is Wednesday, my dudes, and that means it is time for another episode of Codex Radio. I'm your host, Endless Odyssey. It is the 1st of August, 2018, and that means this is episode 30 and part 18 of our reading of Planescape Torment. Last week, the Nameless One tried to bury the hatchet with Anna over some drinks after she attempted to kill him in the previous week's episode. And then decided that the crew was ready to proceed to the location where Anna had found his body. To get there, they had to travel through a den of chaos men, who proved to be an especially confusing and strange faction of Sigil's thugs. We did meet an apparent frenemy of Anna, named Sybil, who was also trying to make her way through the den of chaos men. And once through, Anna was able to lead us to the location of the Nameless One's previous death, and then all of a sudden, the walls started talking to us. Apparently, the alleyway is some kind of sentient being, and it turned out that it was pregnant, whatever the hell that means, but it was distressed because it could not divide while the Lady of Pain's Dabuses were guttling about performing repairs on buildings in the alleyway, and it asked us to dispatch the Dabus, which we managed to do by tricking it into entering a building that seemed to want to kill Dabuses by sealing them inside. After dealing with the Dabus, the alley was satisfied and opened the way into the lower ward for the team. And the team ran their asses off while the alleyway was dividing. And then, right after they escaped that peril, Mort got his dumbass kidnapped somehow. So we're down a Mimmer in the party right now, which is a real tragedy. So hopefully we will find him again soon. But that's where we pick up today. I give you part 18 of Planescape Torment. With Mort's pitch squeals in my ears, I pushed past the merchant whose sharp, cultured accent contrasted starkly against his muttered oath. One hand cradled my shattered coccyx as I shuffled. Looking around, all I could see was a wormy tail as it flicked around the corner of a building. My feet were numb and leaden as I tried to follow, but taking a few steps already proved too much. I fell to my knees as Dakon raced after Mort's voice, fading into the distance far too quickly for him to catch. I pounded the pavement with my fist, cursing myself for adding another broken bone to the list, and cursing those who abducted my companion, the first friend I'd made in this bizarre new life. Anna crouched next to me, saying something I couldn't quite hear through the haze of pain and anger. Damn it. Bones aching and twisted with age, Farad sat gingerly in the palm of his throne. The fingers curled ever so slightly inward, and once, with proper cushions, they had supported his spine just right. Time, however, had not been kind to him. His bones had bent with the weight of years, and every time he rose from this seat, he ached. He gazed into his reflection, cast by the orb in his lap. His face, tainted a sickly mustard by the bronze, was as warped as his body. Gingerly, he sucked at a tooth. Yet another was loosening, yellow and moldy, rank with the sour taste of flesh rotting as it still lived. In the clerk's ward, he could have called for a dentist, perhaps the healing services of a cleric. A potion to cure his ills would have been a pittance, but those days had withered long ago when he fled to the depths in desperation, seeking a way to cheat the damnation that would follow him in death. Farad had the mocking laughter of the other noblemen at his back and the knives of the thugs at his breast when he first fled into these decaying warrens. He had sold his businesses and whittled his gold to gain a foothold and a reputation here. The rest was politics, and Farad had been quick to learn how to pit back-alley shivs against Bloodbringers, black hands against edge dogs, with those same whispers and lies he had perfected when dealing with rivals or magistrates. So much had been sacrificed, so much bloodshed and lives lost like chaff in the wind, for one man to escape the mad cruelty of damnation. Farad caressed the surface of the orb gently, and the metal crawled beneath his fingertips. All he needed now was to learn how to use it. Perhaps an oracle, or... A chill swept through the room. Illwind Court had earned its name from the dusty scent of ancient detritus, not from odd drafts. Drafts were no good for his old bones. But cold there was, the kind of aching cold that comes slowly, devouring the warmth of a flickering brazier, as a father huddles in a blanket during the winter, mourning his sons all lost to war. It was the cold that numbs a mother upon seeing the pallid face of her stillborn infant, and wondering what she could have done to have kept it alive. It was the frost that drifts upon a dead village, blanketing the stiff corpses lying in the streets with only a lone survivor wondering why he was spared. It was the chill of regret. Farad tugged the blankets closer to him with gnarled fingers. As the braziers dimmed, he drew a circle over his heart, as if he could ward off the encroaching darkness. And they came, flickering into substance from the shadows. One by one, they drew themselves from the darkness. Their bodies were warped and misty, eyes gray with unshed tears. Serpentine wisps trailed from their scalps like the hair of bloated corpses swaying in the cold sea. Their fingers were long and needle-tipped, and they flexed as if eager to taste the softness of living flesh. Farad's voice creaked when he spoke.
If you've come for me...
He paused, trying to find the words, and they came out like a whimper, like the whine of a starving alley dog.
I have the sphere! I have it!
Farad held up the bronze orb, and that sickly yellow surface distorted those bent and misty forms further. The creatures floated over to him silently, and Farad clung to the desperate hope that the sphere would hold them at bay somehow.
I have the sphere!
He whined. His throat ached, and tears welled up in his eyes. The sounds of smoke whipping against flesh filled the high hall of Illwind Court, and there was the wet crack of meat and bone under a butcher's knife. Somewhere in the din was a wet scream. By the time the braziers flicked back to life, the blood had grown cold on the stones. Interlude. And that is the end of my part of the telling, Saitavakis says with a bow. With that, she snaps the box shut, and the flow of runes vanishes. There is no applause, no murmurs or cheers. The stark silence of the room is all that greets her when she leaves the stage. Her leather armor creaks as she moves, and the blunt end of her spear clacks against the stage as she descends, melting back into the crowd. I do hope the next storyteller is not going to leave us hanging, Adolin urges, trying to fill the awkward silence with the strumming of his harp.
Give it a moment,
Scale of Three murmurs, coins clinking as he counts them. Like a pinprick, the chatter begins, first as one voice and then as a handful. The whole crowd begins its whispers over the story, correcting misheard details or embellishing others. You sigh. With the drink that had been flowing and the feckless nature of rumor and gossip, 1,000 versions of the tale would spread from the tavern when it's finished. If it ever is finished. Already you can see the patrons glancing at each other. They're restless, and as that begins to build once again, the tavern would be in trouble. Tavern brawls in Sigil are neither small nor legendary, but rather bloody and merciless, doubly so in the Hive. Mykon's nerves are shot. 2 rounds of ale ago, he had pulled out a pipe and stuffed it full with dry leaf. Puffing away with a mug of beer in hand, he had abandoned all pretense of being on duty, not out of laziness, but by the simple sad fact that he was utterly helpless in the throng. You check your pouch with a squeeze, satisfied that there should be enough gold to cover your tab. Shara Sixblade smiles as she offers to refill your mug, pleased at all you'd been downing this whole time. The food is rich, the snacks are salty and well-spiced, and as such it would have been impossible for you to stop drinking now. That marrowless attitude is as matronly as they come, but she would get a customer to drink himself stupid if he didn't wash himself, just to pad her coffers. Well, a few more crisps wouldn't hurt. The flow of ale and wine and beer and whiskey hasn't slowed a hair. Flashes of dim light fill the room each time the door is opened, and each time it admits a pair of burly thugs with a keg on each shoulder, or a few more patrons who were drawn to the tavern. No hive rats are these, no, but high-born men, women, and otherwise, in fine silks. Their faces are veiled with perfumed kerchiefs to block the hive's stench, even as it fades with the day. A woman sways in, wearing a green silk gown and a high wig. Her pale white hair curls around a cage, which holds two small buntings that flutter and chirp as they flit among the perches. She is decked with jewels and clattering with gold bracelets, and somehow had entered the hive alone at this hour without having her throat slit. Three monks then enter, swathed in black robes. Their faces are hard, as if carved from stone, slim, stern, and pious. Still, they approach the bar and order all manner of indulgences a plainer mind could conceive of, in defiance of their vows. And there is the group of a smattering of races, each as different as the next in color and costume, but each muttering to themselves and nodding in agreement, fingering the brooches at their chest. "So I bring myself to this tavern, one I have never seen before, yet imagined in dreams. I've built this bar for some purpose, and I know not what. All shall be revealed by myself, to myself, of this I am sure." A pitched shriek is heard, sharp as a dropped glass and as grating as a fiend's claws on a chalkboard. Fluttering up over the crowd is a mephit, no more than 6 inches tall. In its little claws it carries a tome that shifts among 100 colors. One moment it is circular, the next it's shaped like a spade, and then it becomes a wedge, a square, a slim notebook, before it turns into a circular grimoire once again.
"I is Zorskavit, and my turn it is mine!"
Drunkenly, he flies, and weighed down by the journal, he careens and cracks against a pillar, before flopping proudly upon the stage. With a mad grin, Zorskavit perches up on the stool, cackling at the bewildered crowd as he begins his tale.
"Green and mad, and quickening with the paved glimmers, the one named Knot tumbles from the sea, white and black at the same time, in the same manner. Twice the sum of 4 be 10, which dances into the chillbone night. Sally forth, and shall we be forth to sally, I growled. Find the painted egg we must, for Mordhide's truth to be cracked open, yolk spilling 1,000 thoughts that shall become the nectars of the lathe. Barbed with the sigils of 2 moons, Dakon takes the art most peculiar, smiling a whispered grin greenly. Thus spaketh Monazerth in his 4 truths. I slip into the warm waters and slide the razor across my wrist. Torment, pain, torment, pain, torment, pain. Whip the shade streets with 4 tails, and over the 5th star we go. The path is cobbled with 1,000 of the 3rd fever nights, where delirium springs hot and moist from the skulls of the lost ones. She is green. Rhadamanthus spoke to me in a bubbling voice, gray and silent as the ashen fields from which all life springs. His words spin out in 1,000 needles, each piercing the eye of a sinner. It hurt much to do so, but I melt as ice in the sun. A scream wells from my lips, burst in butterflies. So colorful they are. One becomes a fish, another a thimble. 3 curves into bulbous bubbles and tell me what to write. She is green. Nimbus of the weak we ride, high across the plains, and for each we pass we catch 2 others hidden in a seashell. Ride the winds, I cry. Writhe with the zephyrs like lovers in copulation, and we shall see him knighted at last. And so we did, stepping through the gates of fruition. Dakon is a bowl of milk, lapped up by the cats as the lady consumes the cats in turn, making offal out of the elements. Earth, fire, 12, and air. They swirl in the motes and rides, hardening into four forms that become the ground we float upon. She is green. Dakon is lost to us, but run we must. Run, or else the gates shall open. The gates pass to the elemental plane of bees, and the swarm shall descend upon the world. And thus the bees snag the children in their webs, and carry them off to the nine hells to be tortured forever. Run, run, run! I am tired, but we must run, for the children! Dakon is a bright red candy fresh from the lips of a corpse. He melts in the sun, laughing a laugh most odd. For all the profane arches of sanctity, she is green! Ach, but have ye seen me lucky charms yet, ye blarney-faced laddie? Who is John Galt? The light was ebbing, and the man could not distinguish my face. I had said it simply without expression. But from the sunset far at the end of the street, yellow glints caught my eyes, and my eyes looked straight at the man, mocking and still, as if the question had been addressed to the causeless uneasiness within it. Stop it! Just stop it! Gamir growls. And his thrashing rattles the table he's responsible for propping up. This is stupid! You're stupid! It is absolute and utter nonsense, every last word!
I can't understand a single word!
The lady eats cats?
This is madness. Who in their right mind would let a barmy addle-coved chaos attack perform a telling?
Sai Tavakas snarls from her table.
I would.
A piercing, crisp voice calls out from the crowd. He is a tall man, slim and sharp, with a honed, pointed face. A lizard perches on the rounded cap covering his head, and a pair of smoked glass spectacles obscure his eyes. A dozen necklaces, earrings, and other hangings jingle from his robe as he walks, his limbs cutting the air with each step. In his hand he holds a simple staff, nothing more than a slim, perfectly straight length of wood. It clacks as he approaches the stage in even intervals, quick, precise, and metronomic. Immediately the audience is hypnotized by his slight but imposing figure.
Zorskavit, he chides sharply.
Everything about this man is sharp and angular.
Now, I gave you a chance to tell the tale proper. Hand over the journal.
I have infinite power. Another has infinite power. Others have infinite power. I can cause myself to have infinite power.
The Mephit rolls on the ground, foaming at the lips as it clutches the tome.
I said hand it,
the man snaps, snatching at the book. It transforms into a slim scroll, and with a firm shake, the Mephit slips free. Zorskavit tumbles about on the stage, murmuring gibberish, but more quietly.
Now.
The man clears his throat and stands up tall.
I must apologize and explain in full detail. I am Factor Apetrius of the Fraternity of Order, 25th of 212 Keepers of the Keys of the 18th Great Library in Mechanus, and high scribe to the Libris Occultus on the prime world of Tedrakon.
A governor,
Mycon slurs, clearly well into the drink now.
Odd company for a governor to keep, a Mephit and a chaos man at that.
Factor Apetrius purses his lips slightly.
Yes, I must say it is an odd pairing of sorts. Zorskavit is a handful. When he isn't chewing my wallpaper or urinating on my notes, he spends much of his time stuffed in a blue glass bottle. He sighs. Yet somehow he manages to escape, and I have little energy left to catch him and put him back in.
A most odd-looking journal, that. Adolin fiddles with the strings of his lyre, tuning them to his liking. A thing of chaos, to be sure. Perhaps craft from the formless matter of limbo and scribed with the blood of madmen. How that fell into your hands must be a truly fascinating tale.
Apetrius nods, his voice crisp. Indeed, that in and of itself is an interesting tale. It was a near quarter turning ago, and by that I mean of the central wheel of Mechanus, without a doubt the most precise timekeeping device in the plains. Remarkable device, really, with no detectable margin of error. My office, in fact, rests on a quaternary cog that has a stunning view of the turning.
Ach, you're worse than the diva!
A voice snaps somewhere near the front row. Apetrius crosses his arms. If you would prefer, I could have Zorskavit relate his version of the events again.
No?
Very well.
As I was saying, and this is relevant, mind you, Mechanus is a plane of precision and order, and since I had an excellent view of the workings of the central cogs, I noticed one day, to my shock, that the clock was off by 2/1000ths of a measure. Now I was aghast, of course, and examined the timepiece itself. The thing was Modron craft, and by such accounts the warranty shouldn't have expired for another 318 years, 2 months, 5 days, give or take. Initially there seemed to be nothing wrong, and I had just begun to take apart the entire thing to examine the finer mechanisms when a commotion outside confirmed that just the opposite had occurred, something quite impossible. You see, it was not my clock that had been malfunctioning, and I do wish I had discovered this earlier, for it was quite an expensive clock, but rather Mechanus itself that was off. Well, the Modrons scuttled about, not quite understanding what to do, as such an event had never occurred before, had never been anticipated, and as such no protocols had been written to handle this case. Instead, it fell to the Fraternity of Order to take initiative and help sort things out. The library staff was reduced to a bare minimum as everyone available rushed to investigate the source of the error and correct it as quickly as possible, since it was compounding by the minute. I had been scouring one of the peripheral cogs, and within 2 hours, 52 minutes, and 12 seconds from the start of the search, again, this is merely an approximation, I had discovered this tome wedged tightly between two gears. The damn thing had resisted the crushing forces of the gears of Mechanus, and awed beyond all reasoning, I took it back to the library as Mechanus reasserted itself. Of course, the Modrons were very unhappy about the whole affair, especially when I kept the tome on my shelf and examined it every chance I could get. It was exactly 10 days later that 5 pentadrones knocked on the door of my office while I had been sitting down to tea and indulging in 2 little square-shaped scones. They were under orders to expunge the tome out of Mechanus entirely. Apparently, the order had been given to the pentadrones by a decaton, who was informed as such by a nonaton. The nonaton, in turn, was under the direction of an octon, who received the orders from a septon. The septon had relayed a hexton's message, who had been under orders from a quinton, who was chided quite fiercely, in Modron terms at least, by a quarton. The quarton had been in a mood since the order had come directly from one of the 4 secundi due to the urgency of the matter. Epetrius gave a dry chuckle. So you can see, this matter really had the entire hierarchy rather disoriented. The crowd remains silent. Epetrius clears his throat and continues. Well, in any case, I had sought to study the tome and tease apart what secrets it held, and doing so meant that I had to move much of my equipment to the courthouse and sigil. It was cramped, dusty, and quite frankly the view was quite foul, but if I could study this enigma, it was worth it. To my frustrations, the text resisted all forms of probing, translation, divination, and analysis. I shouldn't have been surprised, of course, but every spell I threw at it simply fizzled, or was utterly useless. So, I turned to the Chaositex, and thanked the powers they were willing to help me on one of their mad whims. For the price of a moldy potato carved up in the shape of a barrier's nose, they gave me Zoriskavet, who they swore up and down by their eyes and arse that he could translate anything Chaos written. Did it work? Adolin strums his lyre, the string sweet and freshly tuned. Epetrius purses his lips. A thought experiment. Pretend that you are trying to inspect an insect under a magnification device. It is a species who holds in its belly something that will unlock the secrets of the multiverse, and the only lenses you are handed are hunks of irregularly shaped granite. That is what it is like working with this method. The governor sighs. But nonetheless, we were able to piece it together over the months, and in that time I've grown somewhat fond of the creature. The tome is maddening to read, and the words continuously shift, if they aren't phasing in and out and through existence, but I can manage now, thanks to Zoriskavet's help. Though quite frankly, sometimes I think the Chaositex had the richer end of the deal. With that, the governor flips open the multi-hued book, which at the moment is giving off a slightly smoky scent, and pierces a page with a firm finger. Now, allow me to continue our tale. Chapter 45. I tried to lose myself in the din of hawkers and buyers, merchants crying out their wares, and the rabble of hagglers in heated debate over the proper price of the goods. One would think that in a crowded marketplace as this, one less voice would go unnoticed. I sighed, feigning interest in an Arborian apple.
I didn't understand what you're on about. He was just a stupid skull.
He's a friend, Anna.
He's obnoxious. Talks too much.
Mort is one who endures well in the Dance of Blades,
Dacon said firmly.
Oh, fine, so we lose a damaged sponge, aye? You're too eager to play pincushion anyway, you barmy sod.
I tossed the merchant a couple coppers and bit into the fruit. Its flesh was slightly tart, with a sweetness that seemed to fairly glow as the juices trickled over my tongue. It alleviated my dour mood just a bit. Mort has answers, and I want to know why he's been lying to me. Anna huffed. Dacon said nothing. As soon as I had crawled out of that ancient crypt, I had looked for a mirror. Craning my neck and twisting a little, I had taken a look at the tattoos on my back for myself. While the marks were there and deeply etched, the mass of scars and burns had rendered many of the words nigh unreadable, unless one knew what the message had said in the first place. No wonder Anna and Dacon had said nothing about the grim instructions and the dire warning that followed. They couldn't have read it easily. Don't trust the skull. It was certain that Mort had read that message off of me before. It was possible that he was a treacherous mole. I had put off the question for far too long out of simple sentiment. The thought of having to deal with him if he betrayed me was unpalatable. I was growing too fond of the little guy.
Take a care, Cutter,
Anna mumbled, pushing close to me. I could barely hear her over the noise of the crowd.
The lower ward may be more impeaceable than the hive, but you might be better off not stirring up trouble you do when the hardheads are about.
Hardheads? She nodded in the direction of one of the heavily armed guards at the doors of the marketplace. They were clad in heavy red armor, crimson as the blood of sinners, and stood stern-faced and tight-lipped. In the hive, the denizens walked heavy-footed, and the rogues swaggered through the streets proud as tomcats. In the lower ward, when the locals weren't hunched over with sickness, they swept through the streets quickly, staring straight ahead with grim certainty. The city guard, however, patrolled in groups of four or five like lacquered juggernauts, with jaws set in stone and fists tight as if ready to break any dissent.
The Harmonium, Dacon said as he leaned in. The Fraternity of Order writes the laws in sigil. The Mercy Killers deal with the guilty, executing the punishments with neither tenderness nor tears. The Harmonium enforce what they can within the walls of sigil, and conquer what they can without. They are not a force to be trifled with. Their ways are to sweep across the plains, bringing their knowing of order to all, willing or not. He scowled. A distasteful philosophy, to enslave worlds so.
I glanced at a long-toothed axe, a crimson man-catcher. Not a group I would like to cross any time soon. Looking away, I noticed a pretty young woman wearing simple clothes. She wandered about the market and examined everything, but didn't seem to be making any purchases. People seemed to be avoiding her, focusing on other things as if trying not to make it obvious. She flashed me a warm smile as I approached. Greetings. I don't suppose you could help a stranger to the ward. The girl's smile broadened.
Hello, I'm Karina. It's a pleasure to meet you, Cutter.
She continued to smile.
What do you want to know?
Well, I had a skull, and it's been stolen from me. Do you know anyone who would do such a thing? She blinked and pressed a delicate hand to her bosom.
A skull? Why do you want such a thing? That's rather morbid, isn't it? Oh, well, if you want a skull, I guess you could get one from the mortuary. Well, maybe not. They don't like to give those things out, now that I think about it. Anyway, I don't know who would take your skull. Why do you want a skull?
He's a friend of mine. Karina gave me a quizzical look.
Really? A skull? That sounds weird, you know. I've never heard of anyone having a skull for a friend. I've seen people with pets and all, but never a skull. But then you didn't say it was a pet. You said it was a friend. So that just makes it weirder.
She paused to think. I sighed. Well, where can I buy some weapons? She smiled and pointed to one of the counters.
Anze over there sells weapons. All kinds of weapons. Are you a warrior? Oh, how silly of me. Of course you are. I mean, how could you not be with all those scars? Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't mention those. You're not sensitive about them, are you?
I shrugged. No, I've gotten used to them. She looked relieved.
Oh, good. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings, or anyone else's, for that matter. You just have to be careful what you say to someone, you know? I mean, people are different, and you never know. What may offend one person may not offend another, so anyway.
She paused for her breath and smiled at me.
Where can I buy some magic?
My skill had begun to outstrip the spells I knew, and the Hive had offered little in the way of high magery.
She smiled and pointed to one of the counters.
Alec over there sells magic things. Are you a mage? You don't look like one, but I guess looks can be rather deceiving. I don't really know what a mage looks like now that I think about it. Do you?
I chuckled. The girl was hardly daft, but she certainly seemed to have a talent for saying so little with so much.
Yes, they wear robes with funny symbols and a pointy hat.
Really?
That's good to know. I mean, mages scare me, so I want to know what they look like. I guess it's all the power they have, and they can do really incredible things and all, but you don't know what they look like. Warriors and priests and, you know, other powerful people just look powerful with all that stuff they carry around that says they're powerful, but not mages.
She paused.
You really like to talk, don't you?
She shuffled her feet and looked embarrassed.
Well, I've been told that I probably talk a bit too much, and, well, people tend to avoid me. And I don't really have any friends or male friends courting me. Sometimes I get lonely.
Her voice became lower and lower until she was finally silent. She stared at the ground at her feet.
I smiled. I don't think you're a bad person, Karina. I happen to like you.
Anna rolled her eyes and huffed.
Karina gave me a hopeful look.
Really? Thank you so much. I don't know your name.
I smiled as I lied through my teeth.
I'm Adon.
She smiled back.
Thank you, Adon. It's nice to know I have a friend.
All right. If you'd be wanting to look for the skull, we'd best be quick about this, Anna said, annoyed.
Anna followed her own advice and kept her fingers clean as we shopped. A few fancy spells caught my eye. The large, blustery merchant tapped the glass counter and smiled at me. He was totally hairless, and his pale yellow skin was scarred as if from burns.
Greetings. I'm Cinda. I heard about you. You be the scarred, clueless fella that be going around the wards asking questions.
You look like you have a few scars yourself. He frowned, then began to laugh.
Aye, that I do. A few years back, I had me a kip set up in the Hive. Some balmy mage decided to burn the ward right out of sigil. Almost took me with it. Sick for a month, I was.
Ignis. For a moment, I stood a little confused and mulled over the span of time.
A month? That's not all that long.
He nodded and took on a faraway look for a moment.
Aye, it could have been worse. Local mage healed me, fixed the scars and all. Could have grown my hair back, but I kind of like the look.
It is quite dashing. Do you think this mage could help me with my scars?
He looked me over, then shrugged.
I don't see why not. Your scars don't look that bad.
He looked at me closely.
Aye, now who's to say? You should talk to him yourself. Name's Sebastian, and he set his kip up over by the foundry.
Thanks. I glanced at the half-unfurled scroll in the glass case. Now, as for your merchandise.
High magic, this is, Cinder proclaimed proudly. Pierce enemies with missiles of force, or surround them with cackling spheres of the heavens distilled. Or mayhap a touch of madness be more to your liking.
Here, Dakon. I handed him a scroll when our purchases were made. You might need this. An attack spell to soften a few enemies from afar. His eyes slid over the scroll casually.
The ways of this form of the art are not known to me.
All paths converge at some point. Besides, I'm of Mebeth School and Xerthamon's, and I do just fine. Dakon nodded and accepted the scroll.
That much is true.
Speaking of which, Dakon nodded and handed me the unbroken circle.
The fifth circle of Xerthamon is now open to you. I wish, as you do, that its wisdom may aid us in finding our companion.
I slid the plates into the configuration Dakon showed me earlier, and a new ring was revealed.
I began to read.
Xerthamon was the first to know the way of freedom, yet it was not he that first came to know the way of rebellion. The knowing of rebellion came to the warrior queen Gith, one of the people. She had served the Illithids upon many of the false worlds as a soldier, and she had come to know war, and carried it in her heart. She had come to know how others might be organized to subjugate others. She knew the paths of power, and she knew the art of taking from the conquerors the weapons by which they could be defeated. Her mind was focused, and both her will and her blade were as one. The turning in which Xerthamon came to know Gith, Xerthamon ceased to know himself. Her words were as fires lit in the hearts of all who heard her. In hearing her words, he wished to know war. He knew not what afflicted him, but he knew he wished to join his blade to Gith. He wished to give his hate expression and share his pain with the Illithid. Gith was one of the people, but her knowing of herself was greater than any Xerthamon had ever encountered. She knew the ways of flesh, she knew the Illithids, and in knowing herself, she was to know how to defeat them in battle. The strength of her knowing was so great that all those who walked her path came to know themselves. Gith was but one. Her strength was such that it caused others to know their strength, and Xerthamon laid his steel at her feet. I slid the plates closed. "What have you come to know?"
Dakon asked, as he himself finished reading the scroll. "There's great strength in numbers, but there is great power in one, for the strength of the will of one may gather numbers to it. There is strength not only in knowing the self, but in knowing how to bring it forth in others."
"You have come to know the fifth circle of Xerthamon. With this knowing, I impart this to you."
He took the circle and, with a deft motion, twisted one of the links so that one of the plates slid forth.
"Meditate upon its teachings, and the knowing of it shall give you strength."
"I would know more of the way of Xerthamon," I intoned, as per the ritual we had adopted. Dakon's fingers felt around the edges of the stone circle, and he twisted it clockwise, the links clicking until they'd settled into a new configuration. He then reversed the motion, resetting the stone.
"The next circle of Xerthamon is open to you. Study it, then I will hear your words."
"Perhaps later." I looked over the new meditation of the Xerth. The power of one. A strength-enhancing spell greater than any I'd seen. A harmonium guard stood next to the exit. His armor was that unusual construction, with spikes flaring from the shoulders, elbows, and forearms. Though he seemed distracted, with eyes wandering about the market, he nodded as I approached.
"How may I help you, citizen?"
He gave me a friendly look, but glanced over my shoulder. "Who are you?" He gave me a slight bow.
"I am Harmonium Guard Corvus, citizen. I help keep the peace here at the market."
He glanced about for a moment, then looked at me. "Tell me about the Harmonium."
"Our belief is simple. We are the light. We are the way. We are order. We are truth. We maintain and enforce order here in Sigil. We police the city."
He looked about again. I followed his gaze. Glancing over my shoulder, I saw Karina wandering nearby. Corvus seemed to have his eyes locked on her as she wandered about. I smiled. "Her name is Karina." He snapped his attention back to me.
"I beg your pardon. You know her, citizen?"
He looked at Karina again.
"Voice of an angel, and such a pretty young thing."
I winked at him, and out of the corner of my gaze, Anna rolled her eyes. "Yes, and she's also lonely. I'm certain she would welcome the company of a gentleman." He glanced at me, then back at Karina.
"Excuse me a moment, citizen."
He stepped around me and headed toward Karina. When Corvus returned, he was smiling brightly.
"Thank you, friend. Wonderful young lady."
He looked a little glassy-eyed. I chuckled, and my mood brightened. "Any time, Corvus." Of course, my mood didn't last when I stepped outside. The air of the lower ward, though clear of the smell of garbage and rank unwashed bodies, had a foulness to it that grew stronger the deeper we went. While the edges of the ward were bearable, the monolithic Great Foundry squatted in the center, belching metallic fumes into the sky. The streets were pitted with acid rain that fell, and the walls of buildings looked as if they had their surfaces peeled away. It seemed as if even the razor vines struggled to grow here, though perhaps it was due to more diligent weeding by the locals. The mark of the foundry lay heaviest on the people. Yellow-skinned as a githzerai, most of them were emaciated or coughing into rags thanks to the slow poison being fed into their bodies with each breath. Such was the price of being a craftsman and enjoying the scant luxuries offered, and the peace that the harmonium brought. And then I saw her. Standing in the shadow of the large gate that surrounded the great foundry was a sickly, githzerai woman. She was hunched and bent, and her constant coughing was obviously a source of pain to her. She held a handkerchief, practically soaking with blood, tissue, and phlegm, to her face. She spied us and hissed. "Greetings." She stared at me and spoke a few mumbled words to Dakon. Dakon glanced at me.
"She cannot understand your speech. She says she is dying."
I reached into my coin pouch. There wasn't much left after purchasing those spells. "Who is she?"
"Her name is Anazi. She says she used to work in a meat-curing house here until half a month ago when the illness became too much for her to bear. She was abandoned, evicted from her home, and left for dead. Speech pains her, and her illness has crippled much of her mind. She says there is nothing she can give you of value."
"And?"
"Know that she will not recover. I can put her out of her misery. That is all. As a Xerth of the people, it is my responsibility to provide an alternative."
I was about to protest. Surely there was a healer at hand, or a potion we could fetch. A short quest would do well to help me forget about Mort's absence, if only for a little while. But Dakon spoke with a rare, grim certainty that I found difficult to argue against.
"Then, be merciful, Dakon."
Dakon drew his blade and waited for the woman to prepare herself. She touched the unbroken circle of Xerthamon he wore for a moment, and her face was stoic. His blade is a blur, and when he completed the stroke, she lay bleeding on the hard stone of Sigil's streets. Her face was blank. She felt nothing. I swallowed and stepped back from the corpse on the ground. "I think it may be best to separate, if only for a little while. If we spread out, it'll be that much more efficient to find word of Mort." Dakon nodded as he focused, and the blood cleanly slid off his blade.
"Ugh, I'm not going to play fetch quest for your mimmer cutter," Anna growled. "Just come back to Farad and say I'm done with you. He won't let me go unless he hears it straight from your lips."
"Please, Anna," I said pleadingly. "Just let us find Mort, and I'll be happy to let you return to the buried village." Her lips curled into a sneer, but she agreed.
"Aye, fine, we'll look for that pet of yours."
Chapter 46. Chaos. It was something every Githzerai lived with, and what every Xerth stood against. Roiling, formless matter without, steel-cored essence within. United, yet sovereign. Ordered in the heart of disorder. Paradox was the bread and water of the Githzerai. Yet the alien angles and alleys of Sigil held a madness of their own, one that Dakon had yet to become accustomed to. It had been so long since he set out on his own that he had nearly forgotten the unbearable weight of his burden, and for a while the clanging iron bands of a long-forgotten vow were a dim whisper in the back of his mind. How things had changed, how old aches returned fresh and burning anew. Dakon looked down at his hands. They were wrinkled and worn rough by the sands of time, but already he could feel new blood pulse through his veins. Something was different about this life. Something was different about this nameless one. Dakon looked up, surprised at where his footsteps had taken him. "Pawn shop," the sign said, scrawled in a desperate hand. The wood was weathered and pitted with age, uncared for and forgotten. This was troubling. The last time he allowed his mind to wander so, it had led to disaster. Yet with a heavy sigh, the old Xerth entered, a speck swept by the currents of limbo. He would save his strength to fight its shifting pull elsewhere. The shop was haphazardly arranged. Useless trinkets and esoteric goods weighed the shelves down until they creaked. While they had been dusted and cleaned with a meticulous hand, The items sat inert on shelves. Only one bored patron browsed the merchandise, and merely with a casual eye. Without him, the shop would have seemed fully becalmed. A rotund woman, complete with shrewish eyes and a nasal voice, brayed out as Dakon entered.
"Now what have we here? A customer? Do mine eyes spy a customer?"
Her voice was pitched and needy, and Dakon suppressed the sudden urge to step back, lest she start pinching his armor and dragging him deeper into the shop in a desperate attempt to make a sale. A diminutive man grumbled, poking his head out from the back room.
"Of course your eyes spy a customer. They see a customer all the time. Customers on the street. We have no customers. We will never have customers. It's useless and forlorn to hope for... Powers, B! Micah! We have a customer!"
His eyes sat alight and excited on the old gith.
"That's what I've been saying to you!"
She lowered her voice and turned to Dakon.
"What can we do for you?"
Dakon clasped his hands and bowed politely.
"I see you, shop mistress, and would know who you are."
It was said that outsiders make such introductions upon meeting. Micah spat bitterly, hands on her hips.
"Aye? I am chained to this anchor of a pawn shop with a husband who doesn't appreciate me enough."
The man interjected with heavy irony.
"And I ask you, how could I not appreciate the mouth and figure of a creature as beauteous as this? Truly without discernment and taste am I. Something I thought marriage could cure, and which hope was entirely in vain. Ah!"
She pursed her lips.
"That fat and lazy sod is Brokaw. He is my husband of 20-some years, though his inconsistent nature makes it hard to believe he is not straight in that time." "It certainly does make it hard to believe," Brokaw shouted back. "All those chances, thrown away when I could have been having the time of my life." "To be sure, the goats on the farm must miss your tender ministrations."
Brokaw purpled, and the two of them fell into what sounded like the latest in a long series of arguments. Their attentions were entirely devoted to each other. Dakon stood, flummoxed, not quite knowing what should be done. Chaos. It was ever the fate of a Githzerai to stand resolute in the eye of the storm. A charred metal tang curled my tongue with each breath I took. I coughed. It seemed as if the filth in the air tested even my immortal constitution. While the folk were better dressed than the poor sods in the hive, and real money clinked into none too limp purses, a dreary air still hung over the populace. Every other sigillian's hands were roughed and scraped. Their skin was sickly. It was a choice between poverty and a short, sickly, and marginally prosperous life. For some reason, I found myself thinking back to how good the soup was in the gatehouse of the Bleak Cabal. A merchant strode past, his horse trotting behind him, pulling a cart laden with baskets of fruit. An artisan on the corner coughed into a rag and spat a thick wad into the street. An older man, decked in elegant robes, blinked at me, his eyes bright and smile warm. He bowed slightly, and I approached.
"Good day, Cutter. I am Sebastian. How may I serve you?"
I shook his hand.
"Greetings." "Greetings to you as well, Cutter."
He seemed distracted as he looked over my scars. His eyes traveled along them, and his eyebrows arched in surprise. Then his gaze returned to me.
"I was about to ask what I could do for you, but seems there is no need. I think I see why you came to see me, Cutter."
"So you're the man who healed Cinder. Can you help me with these scars also?" He smiled at me and shrugged his shoulders.
"Perhaps, Cutter, perhaps."
He leaned forward and began to examine my scars carefully. He ran a finger along several of them, mumbling to himself. Finally, he looked up at me.
"Yes, Cutter, I can help you. I cannot cure you, but I can alleviate the worst of your... condition."
"And your price?"
"Ah, yes, the price."
He began stroking his chin and stared at me. I got the impression I was being weighed somehow, like a slab of meat.
"I have a job that I think you could perform."
I nodded. "Go on."
"I have signed a contract with a certain creature. I am no longer able to fulfill the agreement. It is beyond my abilities. However, the creature will not release me from our deal. Instead, it has threatened me with death unless I fulfill the contract."
"Let me guess. You want me to solve this problem for you?" He sighed.
"Yes, I cannot do it myself. My reputation demands that I fulfill the contract or face the consequences. I am at your mercy in this regard. Will you help me?
With a multitude of demons, divas, and the whole bizarre assortment of other planers, I had to consider things carefully. What kind of creature are we talking about?
An Abishai named Grossik, Cutter.
He paused to gauge my reaction.
I know this is a difficult task, but one I think you can handle. Also, the reward I offer you is great.
He gestured at my scars. What were you contracted to do? Sebastian shook his head.
I cannot reveal that information, Cutter. I am magically bound not to. That is why people come to me. They know that if I accept a contract, it will be handled with discretion.
I see. An interesting proposal. He looked at me hopefully.
Will you do it, Cutter?
Oh well. How bad could an Abishai be?
Yeah, give me the details.
He smiled at me and gave me a sigh of relief.
Thank you, Cutter. You will need a magic weapon to cause an Abishai any harm, so check with some of the shops if you do not own one. A spellcaster can harm it as well. Grossik can be found to the east, beyond the siege tower.
Siege tower? I followed his gesture. Given the mash of architecture in Sigil, it hadn't seemed out of place before, but the moment Sebastian pointed it out, the tower in the distance took on a mystic, sinister air. It oppressed the buildings around it, and seemed to crack at the air and grind at the mortar with its ominous presence. No one seemed to pay it any mind.
Yes, over by the market. Damn thing just appeared one day, several years back. No one knows why, and no one seems to be able to get inside to find out.
I see. Well, I had been hoping you could answer a question of mine. His smile broadened.
Ask away, Cutter.
I had a talking skull, and he was kidnapped. Can you help me? He stared at me for some time before answering. There was an edge in his voice, serrated and sharp with fear.
A skull? Well, if I were to hazard a guess, I would say that your skull is now in the possession of the Master of Bones. Which means you should get yourself another skull, Cutter.
I could feel the tension strung between our words at the mention of the name. Master of Bones. It was its own siege tower in the middle of a conversation. What can you tell me about the Master of Bones? He frowned and glanced about for a moment.
His name is Lothar, and he does not appreciate the attention of others. I know nothing of him and can answer no questions about him.
Where can I find this Master of the Bones? He fidgeted nervously.
A ruined house somewhere in this ward leads to his kip. I know nothing more.
I could actually see a hint of fear in his eyes.
Let us speak of another subject, Cutter.
I turned away from him. That's all right, I was just leaving. Grossik of the Abishai, huh? Well, I had a dagger honed by sorcery and a noggin full of the most powerful spells money could buy. How bad could it be?
Just get it done with, and then you don't have to put up with his ugly eye anymore,
Anna growled under her breath. Playing nursemaid for a clueless was hardly a good way to spend her time. If Anna had learned anything in Sigil, is that there was no mercy in the plains. Assad could be cut open and left bleeding in the street without anyone batting an eye. Children could be left to prowl, hungry and alone, living only by what they could scrounge or steal. Those brave, daft, or desperate enough made their jink on their backs, smiling against the stink of sweat and unwashed sheets. Aye, kindness was a rarity in the plains. The Mercy Killers saw to that for those who escaped the relentless grinding of Sorrow's millstone. If the fear of death didn't teach this piking, bright-eyed sod that, there were plenty of other harsh lessons for him to face. A snap of a string and a patron's purse fell into her palm. The marks were fatter here, though with the prowling harmonium, the dangers were greater. Still, Anna knew a good opportunity when she saw one, and the crowd was too preoccupied with the slave auction to really notice her slinking about. Might as well pull some coin while she gathered information.
Anna?
The tiefling spun around at the sound of her name. Her tail flicked, and in a foolish instant she had nearly reached for her punch daggers when she recognized the voice.
Trist? Is that you?
Anna's heart skipped a beat at the sound of clinking chains. A young woman stood in a cage in the middle of the square, tossed amongst a grimy and sullen-faced group of inmates, no doubt bound for the slave auction. Recognizing Anna, the young woman nodded, dew-eyed and cheeks pink with shame as she looked down at her old friend.
You stupid girl!
Anna hissed.
What have you done now? You were supposed to escape this sort of life.
Her old childhood friend glanced at the guards, and seeing them nod their assent, she knelt on the edge of the podium.
It wasn't my fault, Anna. I did everything right, everything. I married, we had a home and enough money to buy our way into the upper wards. I swear, Anna, it was a fine life. Then what are you doing here?
Anna's fist tightened. The memories were dim, nearly forgotten over the years. They were smudged by the dragging of countless corpses, scarred by the many slit purses and stained with the blood of rivals. A bag of coin, scrounged, stolen, and saved up so that one of them could escape the poverty of the hive. Farad had not been happy when he realized how much had been taken from him.
I was never as brave as you, Anna. I wasn't as clever or quick.
Trist, however, was kind and pretty, soft enough that she would have withered to nothing with another few years of that life.
But my husband, oh, please, you must help me.
A meaty hand gripped her wrist.
Come, girl, the auction's about to start. Let the patrons examine the wares up for bid, and sway your hips a little. The bigger a price you fetch, the more it'll go to pay for your debt.
Please, Anna,
Trist cried as she was being led away.
Help me!
Too shaken to soft-step her way through the alleys, Anna ran. The pavement pounded beneath the tiefling's boots, Anna's eyes searching for the one who was mad, determined, and naive enough to lend a hand. Kindness had long since been slain and left bleeding into the cobblestones, but for the first time, Anna hoped she was wrong. And that's going to do it for this week's episode of Codex Radio. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any feedback for the show, we'd love to hear it. You can go ahead and tweet at me. I'm at @endless_odyssey on Twitter, or you can tweet at the show's account, which is at @codex_radio. If you prefer, you could also send us an email at codexpodcast@myriadtrues.com. That's all I've got for you this week, folks. I'll see you next time.